Israeli forces attack Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds, leaving more than 150 worshippers injured. Palestinian resistance groups and the Palestinian Authority warn Israel about the consequences of its attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque. And CIA Director William Burns says China poses the greatest challenge the U.S. intelligence agency has ever faced. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Tensions have been simmering in the occupied Palestinian territories during the fasting month of Ramadan. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque, Al-Quds City. More than 150 Palestinians were injured and another 400 arrested. Palestinian resistance groups have condemned the attack. Hamas called it a vicious raid and pledged to defend Al-Aqsa at any price. The Islamic Jihad described the attack as a crime and said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its aggression. The Palestinian Authority reacted too, saying that aggression against Al-Aqsa is equivalent to crossing all red lines. It warned that the Israeli attack is a dangerous provocation which could lead to endless wars in the region. Israeli forces have intensified crackdown across the occupied West Bank, killing a dozen Palestinians since Sunday. The crackdown follows a series of deadly operations against Israelis. Iran's acting ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says the latest report by the watchdog on the verification of the 2015 deal is only a technical update. Mohammad Zaghaibi says Tehran had already informed in April that it was moving all of its machines making centrifuge parts from the workshop in Karaj to the Natanz site. He also said that the agency will have no access to data recorded by its surveillance cameras installed in the Iranian nuclear facilities until the deal is fully restored. Earlier, we reached out to our correspondent in Vienna, Huma Lezgi, for more.
So this is a brief explanation provided by the Iranian mission here at the IAEA concerning the latest updates that are being provided by the agency when it comes to its verification and monitoring work based on Iran's commitments under the JCPOA. Of course, we know that because of the rule that was passed by the Iranian parliament and because the fate of the JCPOA currently is uncertain, Iran has gone over and beyond its commitments for a long time now. However, because of this technical arrangement that it had with the agency has been allowed to keep its surveillance cameras in various locations in the country, but not to have access to the information that's been stored in these cameras. This information will remain in Iran, and as you just said, once the JCPOA, and if the JCPOA is restored, and Iran, of course, will go back to its commitments, then this information will be given to the agency. Just to quickly point to the issues that have been raised in this new developments that have been mentioned in the agency's report, we know, of course, that Iran back in January informed the agency that it's transferring its work on the manufacture of centrifuge parts from a workshop in Karaj that came under a sabotage attack blamed on Israel to a location in Isfahan. And then the agency installed its cameras there. Then Iran informed the agency later in April that it was transferring its these machines for construction of centrifuge parts to its facility in Natanz. Now the latest information is that on the 12th of April, the agency finished installing its, or was done installing its surveillance cameras at the site in Natanz to be able to record the information there. It also removed the seals that it had put on these machines when they were in Karaj. And also, I think the latest, the most important part of this new development is that Iran has now informed informed the agency that these machines for creating rotor tubes and bellows for centrifuges are now activated and are now operating in Natanz, because based on the previous IAEA reports, they were still not operating, and they were under seal. That seal has now been removed, and again, the surveillance cameras are monitoring this, but the information will remain in Iran until and if there is a restoration of the JCPOA.
The 8th week of the Ukraine war and day 51 of Russia's military operations there. Ukraine says 5 people have been killed in Russian airstrikes in the east. It says 9 others were also injured in the strikes that hit Luhansk and Donetsk cities, both part of Donbass region. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Donbass is now Russia's main target. In other parts of Ukraine, local media have also reported Russian bombardments, including in the capital Kiev, but no casualties have been reported. On Friday, Russia said that it had struck a factory near Kiev, which made and repaired missiles. Moscow has pledged to increase strikes against the city in response to what it calls terrorist attacks on Russian territory. Russia also says that it has taken full control of a steel plant in the besieged port city of Mariupol. The Russia-Ukraine war keeps driving food and energy prices higher worldwide. The International Monetary Fund says the fallout of the conflict has prompted it to cut global growth forecasts for this and next year.
In the past 7 weeks, the world has experienced a second major crisis, a war on top of a pandemic. We will be projecting a further downgrade in global growth for both 2022 and 2023. Fortunately for most countries, growth will still remain in positive territory. That said, the impact of the war will contribute to forecast downgrades for 143 economies this year, accounting for 86% of global GDP.
The IMF chief said countries which are net importers of food and fuel in Africa, Asia, and Europe risk the biggest growth downgrades. She added that high rates of inflation worldwide are likely to remain elevated for longer than previously estimated. Meanwhile, the European Central Bank raised the alarm about the severe impacts of the conflict on the Eurozone economy.
The war in Ukraine is severely affecting the euro area economy and has significantly increased uncertainty. The impact of the war on the economy will depend on how the conflict evolves, on the effect of current sanctions, and on possible further measures.
The Eurozone inflation rose 7.5% in March compared to the previous year due to a surge in fuel prices. This is a level not seen in 4 decades. Official figures also show the UK inflation rate reached 7% in March, the highest since 1992.
Millions of EU citizens are really starting to feel the pinch. Inflation in the 19-country eurozone is currently at 7.5%. The European Central Bank, ECB, wants inflation to be at just below 2%. It means the cost of living is out of control.
The impact of the war on the economy will depend on how the conflict evolves, on the effect of current sanctions, and on possible further measures.
On Thursday, the ECB said energy prices have increased by 45% in the past 12 months. Business and consumer confidence has fallen through the floor due to the conflict in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia. There are major supply issues. The cost of living is rising, but wages are not, according to the ECB. We have been speaking to EU citizens.
We have also a lot of refugees in Poland, so it's also a huge problem now for our country, for the healthcare system and every other area.
We have to take the car. We're trying to take everybody at the same place and try to share with other peoples, and of course everything in the food also. I mean, it's a big problem. Yeah,
when I drive with a car or something, and yeah, the prices went so high, as a student I cannot pay it.
If the Ukrainian conflict continue, there will be problem, because Russian and Ukraine are two of the most important food producers, so there will be problem about food price.
And as a business person, are you worried about losing your business?
Yeah, it's stopping. If you don't have the parts to construct your thing.
The next update from the European Central Bank is scheduled to take place on the 9th of June. So how badly could things possibly deteriorate for EU citizens between now and then? To quote the head of the bank, Christine Lagarde, who knows? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
CIA Director William Burns has accused China of being a silent partner in what he called Russia's aggression in Ukraine. Burns said China poses the greatest challenge the U.S. intelligence agency has ever faced. He added Chinese President Xi Jinping is a formidable competitor, lacking in neither ambition nor capability. Burns made the comments during his first public speech as CIA director. He said it is more a more complicated and contested world in light of what he called an adversarial China and a revisionist Russia. Ties have soured between the U.S. and China over the past several years as Beijing has stood up against what it sees as Washington's hegemony. The U.S. says China is helping Russia evade Western sanctions imposed over Ukraine. Beijing denies that. Arms trafficking at Italy's main sea dispatch point is ongoing in breach of international Italian laws. Dockers have found U.S.-made tanks in the hold of a Saudi ship docked at the port of Genoa. Max Civilli reports.
Italian ports have often been central to international arms trafficking over the past years. Cargos of weapons destined for war-torn countries have been intercepted in various seaports, including those of Livorno, Naples and Gioia Tauro. On Wednesday, dockers belonging to the autonomous port workers collective CALP found tanks in the hold of the Saudi Arabian ship Bahri Jeddah, which is moored in the Italy's northern port of Genoa. CALP dockers have taken photos of the weapons placed on board the ship and published them on the collective's website.
The ship carries weapons and ammunition. We spotted M1 Abrams tanks already armed, produced in the US. On the deck of the ship, there are also containers full of ammunition and explosives in plain sight. It is extremely dangerous and against international and Italian laws.
About 10 days ago, CALP dockers, together with rights associations and pacifist movements, staged a protest demanding the port authority more transparency on ships' cargoes transiting in Genoa. Dockers have said the demands have not yet been addressed.
These ships carrying cargo of arms and explosives are not just operating in breach of international and Italian laws. Cargo of this sort is extremely dangerous for the dockers and for thousands of people living in the surroundings of the port of Genoa. In addition to that, ships are moored near a chemical warehouse and an oil depot. You can imagine the safety implications of that.
The Weapon Watch Observatory has also found that the number of Italian aircraft carriers that are transporting weapons towards Poland has dramatically increased over the past weeks. Rome has been sending tons of arms and humanitarian aid to Ukraine since the start of the conflict there. The arms industry in Italy is prospering. 10 years ago, Rome was the 10th largest weapons producer in the world. Today it stands as the 6th. Furthermore, following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, the Mario Draghi government has honored a pledge made to NATO a few years ago, rising military spending from 1.4% to 2% of GDP by 2028. Max Civilli, Rome.
France's second round of runoff on April 24th, and the media is finally getting serious about comparing the two candidates' records and proposals. Analysts say the unrest in Ukraine may tip the scales in the toss-up race. Ramin Mazahari reports.
The latest second-round polls in France continue to show that Emmanuel Macron's once comfortable lead has vanished to make the race a dead heat. The mainstream media's insistence on talking about Islamophobia and xenophobia has already produced near-record abstention, but the unrest in Ukraine has forced real issues back to the fore. First the Great Recession, then the Age of Austerity, then the Yellow Vest Civil War, then the coronavirus era, and now an era of Russian sanctions? Devoted Europhile Macron remains committed to a long-term blockade of Russia, which requires years of economic suffering for the average household. Analysts say that voters may prefer Le Pen's France First insistence that any Russia sanctions not bankrupt French homes and businesses.
She's a nationalist, and she's protectionist in some way. She's also protective. She has understood that it was important to sound as someone that would be here to take care of electors. It's whether it's for good or bad, but a lot of French people want to feel that they have a protective hand in government.
Le Pen has also promised to pull out of NATO's command center to restore French independence. Macron is relying on a demonization campaign of the National Front, just like in 2017. When the number two reason people voted for Macron was to block them from coming to power.
He is, in a way, a president by default. The number one paradox of this campaign is that, indeed, we've had 5 years of a president who's managed to be disliked by almost everybody and who yet is favorite to be reelected.
Back when he thought victory was assured, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65 this fall. That may cost him key older and left-wing votes. He's backtracking and saying that he's now willing to listen to the ideas and desires of voters. Do left-wing voters believe Macron's claims that he's now willing to govern by consensus? Does France view Le Pen differently after 5 years of Macronism? The winning candidate may be the one who proves that they have changed the most since the very different year of 2017. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. The third point that I wish to make in the area of the jihad of clarification is that in this jihad and struggle, the path for the nation's material progress and growth must be distinguished from misleading wrong paths. This is an important issue. In one Friday prayer address many years ago, I spoke of insiders and outsiders. As a result of this speech, some people created a commotion saying, "Why do you divide people into insiders and outsiders?" That is why the gentlemen who brought this matter up are the ones who have repeated this idea of insiders and outsiders over and over again in different matters. The issue of insiders and outsiders is a fundamental issue. Insiders does not mean the people who are one's relatives, have the same manners, are in the same political party, have the same opinions and the like. Rather, being an insider is defined one's belief in the path of Islam, Quranic teachings, the Islamic faith, and the great movement of the Islamic Republic, for which great sacrifices have been made. This is important. This correct path must be distinguished from misleading, wrong paths.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the struggle for clarification, this issue is important. And the last point concerning the jihad of clarification, this is a warning for ourselves, is that we must know that if the jihad of clarification is not carried out correctly, materialistic individuals will even use religion as a plaything for their illegitimate desires and aspirations. In other words, if we do not do our job correctly, then he for whom only worldly concerns are important, his own world, in other words, his own desires and ambitions, will even put religion at his service. There is a well-known sentence in the Commander of Faithful's letter to Malik al-Ashtar. Imam Ali Salam tells him to employ people with such and such characteristics. He mentions certain qualities and says that Malik must choose, as his colleagues, people with those qualities. After mentioning those qualities, he says, you should have a piercing eye in this matter, because this religion has formerly been a prisoner in the hands of vicious persons. This is astonishing. Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the days following the Tel Aviv operation, the Israeli entity seemed shocked and shaken as it awaited more operations that would burden the settlers and push them to stay in their homes for fear of what might come next. Gradually, illegal colonial settlers of Zionist Israel are losing their sense of security, and their confidence in their officials is in constant decline, while the security establishment and accordingly the political establishment loses the tools that guarantee it to prevent native Palestinian resistance. What is certain is that this wave of resistance inside the 1948 occupied territories is different from what preceded it, especially the lone wolf runover and stabbing operations that do not have as much of an impact as is the case with the shooting in the streets and squares of the main Zionist cities. Why? Because the effects of the latter are not limited to loss of life, but include the erosion of the sense of security amongst the Zionists and the ability to control the situation. Add to that, the focus of the resistance fighters is on the Israeli cities within the Green Line, away from the occupied lands in Al-Quds and the West Bank, that is, inside the Israeli depth, which is usually safer compared to other occupied territories. Palestinians are dictating the rules of engagement this time. The conflict is escalating in occupied Al-Quds and the West Bank amid Israeli attempts to confine it and prevent the outbreak of a wide confrontation from which the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip will not remain excluded from. However, the Israeli measures represented in stifling the Palestinians in Al-Quds and persecuting the resistance fighters in the West Bank, as per what happened on Saturday when Zionist forces stormed Jenin camp, continue to produce counterproductive results, whether in the rise of the level of challenge in the Bab al-Amud area in particular, or in the development and expansion of shooting operations towards the enemy settlements and soldiers. Israel is currently in a state of chaos and confusion after the Beni Brak operation, which was carried out by the martyr Diyat Hamarshe, and the latest heroic Tel Aviv operation carried out by martyr Raad Hazem. Raad, who transcended more than 9 kilometers away from his first point of attack, where he performed his last dawn prayer and left the mosque, then got stopped by a group of Shin Bet occupation soldiers who asked him to stop and turn himself in. But he decided that his out cue would be exactly as he desired, with the remaining bullets left in his weapon. He fought his last battle and soared a martyr. Such Palestinian resistance burdens the decision makers in Tel Aviv in a very sensitive circumstance saturated with internal and external crisis. The confrontation with Lebanon, Syria, and Iran with all its levels, along with the possible confrontation with the Gaza Strip at any moment, basically shackles Tel Aviv from going too far to reimpose a degree of deterrence in the Palestinian consciousness and retain the now lost sense of security amongst its colonial settlers. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Chaos is the most accurate word to describe the complex scene that gripped Tel Aviv last week in light of the security alert following three lethal operations that left 14 Israeli dead in 1 week. A resistance fighter managed to reach the busiest street in Tel Aviv, Dezen Cove, pointing his gun at the goers of the happiest bar on the street. And just as the happy hour ended, two Israelis were killed and 15 others were wounded, five of whom were in critical condition. The process does not end here. More than 1,000 personnel deployed on the streets of Tel Aviv, including soldiers of the General Staff and the so-called Anti-Terrorism Unit, the Special Police Unit, the Shin Bet, the Shayatit 13 Unit, and the Shaldag Unit. Hours after the operation, they were still unable to identify the resistance fighter. Another failure added to the basket of failures of the Israeli security services, putting the already shaky government of the Israeli entity and its head, Naftali Bennett, at a dangerous crossroads that may actually herald its end. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate. Thank you for being with us. Dr. Wahdan, it's such a pleasure at such an intense time in occupied Palestine. Now, starting with the Palestinian legend, the hero, Raad Fathi Hazem, 29 years old, from Jenin camp in the occupied West Bank. He was martyred after leaving the mosque in Jaffa after he performed the morning prayer in a congregation and clashed with the Israeli special forces that asked him to surrender as he left the mosque, but he refused except to fire what was left of his bullets before he was actually martyred. It seems that this revolutionary war will be a long-running one against the Zionist entity. How do you assess these consecutive resistance operations inside occupied territories?
Thanks for having me, Marwa. And really what's going on is something that should be, should be focused on and should be foreseen, because Palestinians like Raad Hazem, who's been expelled from their villages and from their town homes, like Yaffa in the case of Raad, have been living in miserable conditions in refugee camps. Raad lives in Jenin refugee camps, and all of his family came from a national environment, and two of his uncles actually are martyred. So these operations are conducted in under the slogan of continuous resistance until liberation. Because living under occupation for 75 years now is something that is intolerable for Palestinians, especially the young generation who proved to be focused and who proved to be enthusiastic and running these operations in the middle of such an area which is really secured or considered to be secured for most of the Israelis. Raad had proven that it is doable, it can be done. We can, Palestinians can break through all these security measures and execute their operations really well. And that's what happened. To confront oppression, you have to fight. And these freedom fighters have only done the things that they believe in.
Definitely, so, Dr. Wahdan, we see that now the Zionist entity, the occupation forces are preoccupied with guerrilla operations and with popular resistance all across the occupied territories. They're trying to prevent settlers and the soldiers to feel security or stability, especially in Tel Aviv, which was a major success, which actually confused the enemy and led it to storm Jenin camp, as we saw on Saturday. And since Saturday, it has been clashing with Palestinians in a lot of territories of the occupied land in an attempt to impose some sort of a new deterrence equation against the Palestinians. But isn't this sort of violence against Palestinians which prompted the guerrilla freedom fighters to begin with to attack? It seems like Israel is just caught up in a loop now.
But continuous confrontations with the occupation power, with the apartheid regime, has been going on since the beginning of last century, but it comes in waves, and now is another wave of confrontation, another wave of intifada, popular intifada, that is going on in Jenin on daily basis. It's not only these days that the Israelis barge into Jenin refugee camps. We remember 2002, the massacre of Jenin that the Israelis carried against the Palestinians. But during the year, day in and day out, Palestinians in Jenin are fighting the occupation and are resisting the occupation with all means that they have. But in filtrating to through the apartheid wall and reaching to inside Tel Aviv, which is the capital, the economical capital, and it's the political, actually, capital, this is something different. And the last two operations that were done in Tel Aviv have caused these security forces a lot of frustration, because they cannot understand why these operations, military operations, are done within these areas, and how these freedom fighters infiltrating through this.
Sure, obviously, because they are shocked at how their ancestors lived their lives genocidally against the Palestinians to create the safe haven for them. But in the end of the day, this is not a safe haven, because this is an occupied Palestinian land. But how long do you think, Dr. Wahdan, will it take for the resistance factions inside of the Gaza Strip to actually just get on board that wave?
Well, as long as statements, different resistance groups have declared that Jerusalem is a red line, and if the Israelis continue their oppression against Jerusalemites, and if they continue to barge into Al-Aqsa Mosque, this means a regional war. Well, now we are in Ramadan month, and the occupation is barging into Al-Aqsa. Ben Gavir had went into Al-Aqsa a few days ago. Labid had I mean, this is an act of incitement against the Palestinians. So I think it's going to be time when our people in 1948 will declare another, perhaps another strike, another day of strike, like last May 18 of last year. And if the 1948 joined forces with the resistance in Gaza and with the popular resistance,
it can show them that it can also hurt economically, not only politically or militarily.
Yeah, security and economy is very sensitive for the, for the occupation. And if you shake their security, as the three last the four actually last operation in Nagaf and in Khadera
And Beni Brak and Tel Aviv.
In Beni Brak and Tel Aviv, this is horrible. They cannot take. This is a community of settlers who were convinced, who were brought into Palestine.
To live the happy life, to live the dream.
Yes,
well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate from Occupied West Bank, for being with us to talk about this. We have been, for the past 74 years, telling them to pack their bags and leave, but seemingly now they will do it on their own. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Amal. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Saudi Arabia sacked Yemen's Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, the Saudi coalition of aggression got rid of former ousted Yemeni President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi days after the start of the armistice in Yemen, where it was announced that Hadi had stepped down in Riyadh and handed over his powers to a presidential council. A presidential council which was formed based on previous U.S.-British proposals that were circulated several months ago, which Hadi had previously rejected during his meeting with the U.S. envoy to Yemen, Tim Lenderking, last month. Now, until his last appearance during a breakfast banquet held for the participants in the Riyadh consultations, Hadi was renewing his adherence to the three illusions, which would allow him to remain as the transitional president. However, a coup against him led by the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ended with his dismissal along with his deputy and with the formation of the so-called new presidential council. Hadi out by orders of bin Salman in this following report.
After long hesitation and perseverance, Saudi Arabia decided to turn the page on Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi, the former Yemeni president for whom war is supposed to have been declared at dawn of 2015, is lastly removed from the scene, which was originally occupied only by a figure, to be replaced by a presidential council, which Riyadh considers to be the most capable of leading the next stage following the UN-brokered truce. It is a step that has been long overdue, but the kingdom no longer has an option in light of the major transformations that have occurred during the 7 years of its absurd war on Yemen. Thus, simply, Saudi Arabia abandoned the hook on which it had hung all its evils in Yemen, acknowledging its failure to achieve one of the most important goals of its aggression, which is to restore so-called legitimacy to Sana'a. Nothing will change for Hadi, who has become a prisoner of a hotel in the Saudi capital, while his deputy Ali Mohsen Al-Ahmar, who was placed on the Saudi coffers to supply fighters and bargain with tribes, will find himself unemployed. As for the kingdom, it is re-engineering the relationship between the forces loyal to it and those of its rivals in the UAE, giving all of them shares in the presidential council, which will have to start negotiations with the Houthis under the supervision of the United Nations, according to the Saudi dictates. Although Saudi Arabia is trying to manage this new council, as it has always done, by pretending to distance itself from the conflict scene, its decision may indicate that it has begun to deal with the idea of ending the war seriously and realistically. Nevertheless, the possibility that Riyadh is in the process of exploiting the truce in order to rearrange the positions of its allies in preparation for a new chapter of aggression remains intact, especially if the kingdom is still hoping for direct American support. Particularly since earlier there was talk about an American-British desire to appoint the leader of the General People's Congress, the foreign wing Rashad al-Alimi, as a replacement for Hadi. This was already achieved right after Hadi was forced to resign, while the differences between the forces loyal to the Saudi and Emirati alliance were allegedly resolved by granting UAE representatives the powers of the Vice President of the Republic. It is worth noting that Rashad al-Alimi has distinguished contacts and relations with influential people in Washington, and that branded him as the United States man inside Yemen. The influence of his network of relations was evident in the decisive meeting he had with the American envoy to Yemen, Timothy Lenderking, hours before his appointment to the head of the Presidential Council, with absolute powers that the members cannot challenge. All the while, Ansarullah's comment to this new event was reflected by the member of the party's political bureau, Muhammad al-Bukhaiti, who said that the establishment of a Presidential Leadership Council by order of former President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi does not represent the will of the Yemenis, describing the council's head, Rashad al-Alimi, as America's man.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Muhammad Abed. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Abed. Now, over the years, Hadi's authority was shattered until he was forced last week at dawn on Thursday to broadcast his resignation statement and to delegate his powers to a so-called presidential council to manage this new transitional phase in Yemen. But isn't this the same legitimacy that Saudi Arabia was supposedly defending for the last 7 years in Yemen to reinstate Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi as the legitimate president of Yemen?
And this serves also to underline once again the absurdity of this war, the illogical steps that have been taken by the Saudi administration, basically by MBS Mohammed bin Salman, over the past 8 years in this regard. 1 month after the beginning of the war, it was really understandable to anyone who knows in military field that it was impossible for the Saudis to win the war. But still they went on and dragged on and on for around 8 years now. Once again, they are trying to get something from their defeat. Everybody admits that they have been defeated, that the Saudis have been defeated. All their militiamen are not able to achieve anything on the ground other than fighting with one another and taking the money that is being supplied by the Saudis and the Emirates and other Western countries. But still, like the mentality of the gambler, the more they lose on the table, the more they say, okay, maybe if I take this step or try this game once again, I can achieve anything or gain anything. To combine all these foes, basically, because some of the parties of the presidential council have even entered wars between each other. And now the Saudis hope that they will be unified against the Houthis. So once again, another attempt, another failure will be facing the Saudis.
Well, basically, Rashad Adimi's close relations with the decision makers, whether in Riyadh or his distinguished relationship with influential people in Washington, branded him, as you said, the man of America in Yemen. Now, he is appointed as head of the presidential council with absolute powers. Even the members cannot actually stand in his face in this. How will replacing Hadi with al-Alimi help Saudi Arabia achieve what was unable to achieve over the past years of continuous aggression and siege over Yemen? How will they be able to do that when, at the same time, the council is not united?
Yes, as I was saying, once again, the mentality of the gambler, the more you lose, the more you try other doors, the more you try other things that you have not tried in the past. excuse me. And so this was also the step of the holding the negotiations between the parties that all met in Riyadh. This means that they are all allies of Saudi Arabia and they are all backed and financed by the Saudis. So once again, illogical step at all. I mean, the whole war was waged by the Saudis under the pretext or the narrative of restoring the legitimacy of the Yemeni government. Once again, they, by themselves, and with this step taken last Thursday, they removed this so-called legitimacy of Hadi and replaced them with another. Plus, the unconstitutional step here is that the president, even if Hadi is to be recognized as the president, he does not have the constitutional right to take such a step and form the presidential council. So at all levels, the Saudis are in a quagmire. They want to get rid of this war. They want to end it. But still, every time they are hoping that they can achieve something here
or there.
That's
the main question here, because although Saudi Arabia always tries to distance itself from the conflict scene, its decision to get rid of Hadi may actually indicate that it has begun to deal with the idea of ending the war seriously and realistically this time. However, why would Sana'a, or how will they, even if they want to, how will they be able to accept this new U.S.-Saudi made presidential council as a legitimate opposing party that they could negotiate with in order to ensure sustainable peace when it's Saudi Arabia itself that, like a puppet, removed Hadi, brought this man who supposedly is being hired by the U.S. and the U.K. without any referendum, without any elections by the Yemenis? How and why would they accept that?
Yes, this is basically the main point here. And the Yemeni, the Sana'a government and the Ansarullah leaders have been really very clear in this regard. They are not going to negotiate because the puppet regime has appointed another puppet regime.
So you think this is just a break before another wave of aggression?
Yes, because of the meetings that were held by the Presidential Council members, basically most of the meetings were military, in military directions. So, but once again, I don't expect that they are going to achieve the thing that the Saudi themselves were not able to achieve. So, but in this regard, maybe the Saudis are waving that, okay, you come back to our negotiating table, or we have this something in our pocket, which is the Presidential Council and the militia that they have, and they are preparing themselves to launch more aggressions against the Yemeni people. So it is the Saudis really want to get out of this quagmire, but still trying to achieve one way or another any gains, any thing that face-saving in order to tell the people that, okay, we didn't waste 7 years of war and all the money that was spent in this regard and expenditure to achieve it, and we gained nothing.
Well, it seems that these couple of months, especially after the holy month of Ramadan, will speak a lot about how Saudi Arabia will be managing this presidential council and what will happen next. Maybe it's just a halt until the war begins again, and maybe it's a real step towards something that resembles a resolution in Yemen. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator, joining us from Beirut to talk about how Saudi Arabia decided to sack Hadi and replace him with another puppet council that may or may not end the war in Yemen. Thank you for being here. I'll see you next week on the Middle East Stream.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are our true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
We're waiting for you to be my
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, as you know, we have been discussing about Mahdawiyat, Imam Mahdi, in this session. And we discussed about the narrations of Sunni scholars who say that Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala farajahu belongs to the lineage of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and only one narration that was mentioned in some of the sources was inappropriate in terms of chain and as well as in terms of content. It was mentioned Hassan at some places and Hussein at some other places. So we analyzed many narrations, not from the Shia school of thought, but all from the Sunni school of thought, wherein all the narrations say that Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala faraja belongs to the lineage of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Dr. Karimi, do we have anything pending in this session? If yes, I would want you to add to that.
So we said that, first of all, as you rightly mentioned, there is only one narration claiming that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is from the lineage of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. And this narration is weak in terms of the chain. Second of all, there is another version for this very narration, which according to that version, it is referring to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And the third point that we mentioned was that there are many Sunni sources referring to the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is from the lineage of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
And this was very interesting that you answered this claim only using the Sunni sources. We did not mention any of the Shia sources explaining that.
Exactly. And so even if we are going to compare, we have one weak narration in one side, and on the other side, we have many narrations referring to Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
So it's like senseless to focus on the weak narration, and exactly, that too, which is weak also in terms of chain and also in terms of content.
Exactly. And so these are the points that we shared. The next point that I would like to mention is that even if one is going to insist on that one narration, again, my new point is that it's not against the beliefs of the Shia. Why? Because from one perspective, Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, can be regarded as an offspring of both Imam al-Hussein, as well as Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam.
Oh, I was about to ask you that. Is there something wrong if Imam belongs to like Imam Hassan alayhi salam?
Yeah, it's possible. How? The point is that the wife of Imam Sajjad, our fourth Imam, that is the mother of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, is Fatima, the daughter of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam.
All right.
So from his mother's side, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is, can be considered as an offspring of Imam al-Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam as well. Why? Because the mother of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is the daughter of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam.
All right.
Now, here one may claim that no, I mean, when it comes to the lineage, we only consider the fathers and not the mother.
How do you answer that now?
To answer that, we have two verses of the Quran which proves that no, I mean, when it comes to lineage, we can consider mothers as well.
Like that of Isa and Maryam.
Yeah. We have two very important verses, because sometimes some people ask the Shia that why do you call your imams as sons of your prophet?
Prophet, yeah.
They are the sons through Fatima. And so you shouldn't do that. It's, I mean, we need to only consider the lineage through the father. So it's wrong to call them Yabna Rasulullah or the son of the prophet. But the point is that the Quran says that not only we are allowed to do that, we need to do that. The first point is that this is mentioned in verse 61 of chapter Ali Imran, which is famous as the verse of Mubahala. We know that a group of the Christians, they came to the Prophet, they had a debate with him regarding Jesus alayhi salam, whether he's God or son of Mary, or I mean a human being. They were not convinced, and finally the Holy Prophet invited them to come to a mubahala or a mutual curse, to curse each other and to ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to punish the party which is telling the lie. Then we know the story that on the next day the Holy Prophet was accompanied by Imam Ali alayhi salam, Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha, and Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And seeing the scene, they regretted and they said that no, we are not going to take part in this mubahala, because the leader of them says that if you do that, then all the Christians would be destroyed.
Dr. Karimi, I'll be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. This is verse 61 of chapter Mubahala. فَمَنْ حَجَّكَ فِيكِ مِنْ بَعْدِ مَا جَاءَكَ مِنَ الْعِلْمِ. For those people who have come to you, they have a debate with you, although they know, they have the knowledge, then invite them. نَدْعُوا أَبْنَاءَنَا وَأَبْنَاءَكُمْ. O Prophet, tell them, let us call our sons and your sons. وَنِسَاءَنَا وَنِسَاءَكُمْ. Our women and your women. وَأَنفُسَنَا وَأَنفُسَكُمْ. Ourselves and yourself. ثُمَّ نَبْتَهِدْ فَنَجْعَلْ لَعْنَةَ اللَّهِ عَلَى الْكَاذِبِينَ. Then we curse each other. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to punish the liars.
Yeah.
Now the point is that this verse is one of the famous verses talking about the virtues of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Why? First of all, Imam Ali alayhi salam is called the nafs, the very self, the very soul of the Prophet.
Yeah.
Because anfusana, ourselves, refers to the Prophet and Imam Ali.
In the worst, and the Prophet is getting Imam Ali alayhi
wa nisa'ana, our women, is only referring to Fatima al-Zahra salamun alayha. And let me refer to the fact that this incident has been mentioned in both Shia and Sunni sources. So it's not only a Shia claim.
Yeah.
Then our point is that in this verse, the Holy Prophet says, Abna'ana, our sons. So, who accompanied the Prophet? Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And the Holy Prophet himself calls Hasan and Husayn alayhi salam as his sons, not as his grandchildren, for example.
Yeah.
So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in this verse, this is not the saying of the Prophet, this is a divine verse. Allah is addressing all Muslims that Hasan and Husayn, Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, are the sons of the Prophet. Although they are through Fatima al-Zahra, although they are through a girl, but they are the sons of the Prophet. You can call them Yabna Rasulullah. So this is one very clear verse which tells us that we can call our sons through the lineage of their mother.
Lineage can be from mothers as well.
Exactly.
It's not necessarily.
We're not talking about
fathers.
I mean, jurisprudence, fair inheritance, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
No, that's another issue. The other verse in this regard is two verses from chapter Al-An'am, verses 84 and 85. And these two are very interesting to prove our claim and our idea and talking about some of the prophets. In verse 84, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ وَوَهَبْنَا لَهُ إِسْحَاقَ وَيَعْقُوبَ. And we gave him Ishaq, it is Isaac, and Yaqub, Jacob, كُلًّا هَدَيْنَا, and guided each of them. وَنُوحًا هَدَيْنَا مِنْ قَبْلِ, and Noah we had guided before. وَمِنْ ذُرِّيَّتِهِ دَاوُودَ وَسُلَيْمَانَ وَأَيُّوبَ وَيُوسُفَ وَمُوسَى وَهَارُونَ. And from his offsprings, that is the offspring of Nuh, from his lineage, from his dhurriya, from his offsprings, which may refer to Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, the following prophets, داود، سليمان، أيوب، يوسف، موسى and هارون، وكذلك نجزي المحسنين. And thus do we reward the virtuous. Next verse says, وَزَكَرِيَّا وَيَحْيَا وَعِيسَى وَإِلْيَاسَ. So it is referring again to the Dhurriyyah, to